two questions, so these would be, I guess, for you to muse, but you mentioned hell twice, once this morning and then once in your sermon Sunday morning,
yes,
in which you added a comment that it's not very popular to talk about in Western Christianity, so we're going to talk about it there. But I'm curious about that observation that you made and what you'd want to expound on that.
Yes.
And then the second one, very different question, in your travels around the world, what is the most amazing thing you've seen where people are keeping their eyes focused on Jesus? What's the most amazing outcome that you've observed?
Let me attempt to take them in the sequence you presented them. The issue of heaven and hell and my comments about Western civilization's attitude towards hell are really a personal reflection, just based on a limited experience and some readings. From the age of reason and enlightenment in Europe, Christianity became mostly considered as a cognitive assent rather than volitional activity. And what do I mean there? A lot of Western Christians think that you are a Christian because you agree to the precepts of the faith. And there's some truth there, but the whole truth is not there. A cognitive assent to the precepts of Christian faith is not necessarily the kind of Christianity the New Testament proposes. Not even the kind that Paul is recommending. That we work with patient endurance and keep grinding at the wheel until it happens. No matter what, even if we are crucified like Jesus, then indeed we are following him. Rather, the easy way has crept in to a kind of a reasonable approach to getting the better life. And often the better life is located here on earth. So a lot of people are fighting to be ahead, to get a better life here on earth. For the short part of real life, we want it better. And sometimes we get lost in the pursuit of those earthly goals and forget that this is a launching pad. This life is a launching pad, not the landing strip. This is not our home, you know? And so when Christianity becomes cognitive assent, then it is a mental process or a mental game, so to say. Volitional activity is where you are now recruited by your faith to be a soldier of the cross. You understand suffering. You understand that you are blessed when you are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And everybody looks for some righteousness to be engaged with, because this is not the ultimate life here. We are trying to get back home safe and sound. That the entire existential experience becomes a way to get back home safe and sound. So home becomes the vocation of this life. Getting back home. You know, it's like when you get lost. You know, you want to get back home. You want to get back home before you go shopping. You don't want to remain lost and go shopping. If you ever were lost, you don't function normally when you are lost. You first try to be found, then you function normally. The unfortunate thing is that some people have been lost and they've made it a natural life. The Bible said that fall is a great fall. So that's what I meant, that in a reasonable mind, when you start talking a lot about hell, it brings a challenge to the mental construct that all I'm focusing on is for naught. It's a shock. And sometimes if you are not the pastor of a people where you're going to be with them to work through that shock, then it's better not to just throw the bomb and walk away. That's what I was referring to. When I, you know, it's not that Westerners don't want to hear about hell, but you don't go drop the hell bomb and then walk away after 2 days. You got to stay there and work with people to sort through it. It's much like your question about Chicago, you know. If you're going to help a kid that's living in violence, you got to stay with them or put them in a track that helps them get far enough until they can see the options to this kind of misery and believe in it and long for it. Because every human soul is longing for something, for fulfillment, for satisfaction, for integrity, you know. But sometimes it's a cause lost before you even get started fighting for it, because it's like a voter who is dismayed with politics and say, you know what will my one vote do? I'm just not going to vote today. I'll go get me a cup of ice cream. They've given up on what their vote can do, what difference it can make. You know, now, on my travels around the world, your question was, on the travels around the world, what difference have I seen?
What's the most amazing thing you've seen God doing? Oh,
traveling
in communities where people are focused on Jesus.
What is or what are some of the most amazing things I've seen from communities of people focused on Jesus? Ooh, I've seen miracles. I have seen miracles. I've seen literally, I'll give you an example with an uncle of mine. He served in the U.S. Air Force as a mechanic, an aircraft mechanic. And after he retired, a few years following his retirement, he retired in Fayetteville, North Carolina, where he was last stationed before retirement. And he's married to an African-American woman. They have their children. Then he was diagnosed with cerebral meningitis. And the physicians here will know better about it than I can even imagine. And his head became bigger than a football, not an American football, a soccer ball, a basketball. It was bloated head. He was in coma. And he was moved from the VA hospital in Fayetteville to the UNC hospital in Chapel Hill, which was a good distance for his wife and family to commute daily. After the doctors did what they could do, they came to the conclusion that they can't really help him. His situation is what it is. So they then recommended to move him back to the VA hospital to be at least closer to his family and see what plays itself out. Two of my aunties, who are like the two toughest people in the Boyu clan, you don't want to be on the other side in an argument with them. They are sort of brutal, you know. One of them used to beat up his her husband all the time and then tell him not to cry. Of course, they got divorced, and whenever he shows up at a family event, he hides so that she wouldn't know he's anywhere around, you know. And so those two aunties, when they heard the doctor's recommendation to move their brother back to Fayetteville, they objected and threatened the doctor, "We will sue you for everything you have." And they became un-boy-like. And the doctors got afraid with the threat of a lawsuit and all of that. I suppose the doctors began to talk to the lawyers for the hospital to make sure whatever they did according to law. And that lasted for 2 days. And 2 days were just enough, because we have been praying and praying. And on the second day, the two aunties have come from their hotel room to visit their brother. They're walking down the hall and, expecting the same old. They get in the room and their brother is sitting up. His head is back to normal, and he greets them by name for the first time in 4 months. And when they saw him, they ran away, because this is not believable that he's dead. So they thought he had died and maybe his spirit came back. And so he's like, "Where are you going?" And they are running down the hall, and the nurses see them running, and the nurses come and see my uncle, and they join the running group. And so there's this throng of runners down the hallway. They meet the doctors, and the doctors like, "What happened?" And the doctors join them, and they run for a while, and the doctors realize, "We are the doctors. We can't be running from our patient." So they stop, and they came back, and they sat him down, and he's saying to them, "Where am I? What am I doing here? Where is this?" You know, he's gained consciousness. Amazingly, we were praying for that, But we never thought our prayer will amount to anything. And you know, from a scientific Western cognitive standpoint, maybe it was just some chance. But from a deeply spiritual standpoint, God is at work today just like God used to be at work in the days past. It's just our perspective of God's activity in history that has changed. These are biblical days. And there's nothing new under the sun. I've seen things from that to things where a young boy born to AIDS-infested parents in Southern Africa and is literally just left there to live and die comes across somebody who observes the child, adopts the child, and that child becomes a neurosurgeon. You know, I've seen where there was an older white layman from Georgia that was on the general board of Global Ministries with me. Between, I met him there in 1996. He was in his second quadrennium serving, and I was in my first quadrennium, and you could serve two quadrennia. And nobody liked him on the board because he was so conservative. Even a conservative may not have liked him all the way because he was strict like the Rock of Gibraltar. You know, for example, when the board will meet, and you know the mission board of the United Methodist Church is a little bit towards left of center. Because whenever you go beyond your own culture, you become at least moderate. Maybe even some little bit liberal. Because you realize the world is not just like your world. And to function in it, you have to accommodate the realities of all of God's people. So you can't just be strict, regimented according to your view of life. And so the General Board of Global Ministries is the agency of the United Methodist Church that reaches the rest of the world. And they have discovered in so doing the realities of the other peoples of the world. So their programming will be criticized by the most conservative people. For example, this gentleman, every board meeting, he would stand up at the opening session of the board. After we'd go through organizing and all of that, and it's time for business, he will raise his hand for a moment of personal privilege. Then he will move to the microphone and position it. And all the church press, from the liberal ones to the conservative ones and to the in-between ones, will be taking pictures. And he will stand there, and he knew that that would be the case. And then he will take his sheet of paper from his pocket that he had pre-written. And it would be a scathing criticism of the General Board of Global Ministries. It would say things like, the board is supposed to be evangelizing the world, not cooperating with socialists. And the socialists were usually Southern African countries, those countries that were most recently oppressed by white people and just got their freedom. And they are trying to sort. I mean, when you just get your freedom, you are not the friendliest person with the person you had to fight to get free. That's just a human thing. In the early days of the American Revolution, Britain was not our closest ally because we were fighting them for freedom. But we soon forget how we used to be. When we are no longer that way, we don't allow other people to go through their experiences of the fight for freedom, you know. And so those Southern African countries, the United States did not befriend them. Great Britain did not befriend them. France did not befriend them. Germany did not befriend them. So China befriended them. Cuba befriended them. One time Nelson Mandela said to a question about that, he says, look, our friends cannot just be your friends. We pick our friends based on our interests. If you share our interests, you are our friend. If you believe in us being free, like you are free, then we are friends. But if you don't believe in us being free like you are free, how in the world should we listen to you on who our friends should be when your interest is to keep us in prison? So Joe was despised by the board members because he just did not understand why the board had to reach to the world the way it was doing. So one day the general, I befriended Joe. I'm the odd guy. You know, I always like to give a lot of space for the grace of God. So when I noticed that no one would sit with Joe, I would sit with him. So one day the general secretary called me and said, "Charles, what's wrong?" I said, "But what?" He says, "Joe." I said, "I don't know. Is something wrong?" He said, "Well, you're always sitting with him. Don't you realize that nobody likes him around here?" I said, "Yes, I realize that, but I realize that somebody likes him, and that's me. He is a United Methodist. I am a United Methodist. And it's not right for us to ostracize him like this. Yes, I don't agree with everything he is saying, but how will we understand why to be brothers and sisters in the same household of God?" So he said, what do you want? What do you think we should do about him?" I said, "Thanks for that question. I really appreciate that." I said, "You invite him to go with you on a mission trip in some of the most desperate places in the world where we are at work so that he can see and experience for himself why." He said, "You think it's going to work?" I said, "Well, try it." And to my surprise, Dr. Randolph Nugent invited Joe on that trip to Namibia, Mozambique, and South Africa on one 10-day tour. And there were a few other board members on that trip. I was not one of them. I went to Senegal, the story I shared yesterday, on a different trip. So after they came back, and I didn't even know that he had invited Joe. I didn't know that Joe had gone with him. I just knew a team went to Southern Africa. So at the next board meeting, and the board met twice a year in April and October, at the April meeting, I see Joe sitting on stage with the general secretary. So I'm like, "God, what has gone wrong here?" They invited Joe on stage. Then we went through devotions, and the general secretary went up and said, "We had a mission to Southern Africa, to Angola, Mozambique, and South Africa. And one of the board members who went on the trip is going to now bring you a report, Joe." And Joe gets up with his crutch, you know, because he had had a knee surgery and he walked with a limp. And he went up. This was a distinguished layman in the United Methodist Church, a CPA and all of that kind of thing, you know. So he went up, got there, reached for his glasses, put them on, then reached in his pocket for a handkerchief, lifted the glasses, and was wiping away what appeared to be tears. Then he cleared his voice and lifted his head. This time the tears were rolling, and he just let it go. He says, "Something amazing happened in my life last month. The general secretary invited me to join a mission tour of Namibia, Mozambique, and South Africa, some of the most desperate countries in Africa, some of the most recently freed country in Africa." He says, in Namibia, we went to visit a region that has landmines planted all in the ground. He said, "I saw with my eyes little girls and boys with no legs, no limbs. And I saw graves of many more who had died from being blasted off by landmines." Then he told us why the landmines were there. In the Revolutionary War, both the white regime and the guerrillas had planted landmines so that the other side would get blown up. When the war ended and Namibia got free, nobody cared to go there and remove them, because the country didn't have the money to remove them. And a year before Joe's trip, Joe had voted against buying a $1 million landmine removing machine. The vote passed, and the machine was bought, but he gave a scathing criticism. "Well, we're wasting our money on $1 million equipment to remove landmines instead of evangelizing people to believe in Jesus Christ." He voted against it. But this time Joe was saying, Now I see why we needed that landmine machine that I voted against last year. So he reached in his pocket, pulled out an envelope, opened it, and said to Dr. Nugent, the general secretary, can you please come up? This $25,000 is my first contribution to the next landmine removing machine. You could have heard a pin drop, and then you couldn't have heard it when the crowd got up in a standing ovation for our brother Joe, who through the grace of God and an opportunity to see what he had always had a strong opinion about and to experience it for himself, was transformed. And he had gone to his church in Georgia and told them the story, and they gave him a $25,000 check and said, we want to be a part of making the children of Namibia have life and have it in all its fullness. Perhaps for Joe, the fullness of life took on a new meaning when it came to Namibian children for the first time in his life. And we owe it to each other to go easy on each other, to try and understand each other, because God is at work if we only allow God's work to emanate through us. You know, if we only fix our eyes on Jesus and not politicize or make an ideology out of our opinions and be rigid about them, because none of us is God. If we fix our eyes on Jesus, it will become clearer to us that we are not God. And we'll say, thank God I'm not God. And let God be God all by God's self. Yes.
How do you think Zimbabwe is doing now?
Well, Zimbabwe is still trying to be free. You know, like my comment about Chicago would be similar about my comment about Zimbabwe. People are essentially the same, just in different contexts. Zimbabwe had a long white rule. The last white prime minister, Ian Smith, finally gave up in 1980 when Zimbabwe got its political freedom. But most of the land of the country was still owned by the former white settlers, who had sort of distributed among themselves, and the majority of black people were sort of pushed into what were like homelands. Or in America, they call them reservations, you know. So those black people, after independence, wanted their land back. They had a kind of historic right to the land. They had not consented to sell it to any white person. But a white government, a minority government, had done that. So they needed to address that. But their first president, Robert Mugabe, who just got overthrown months ago and replaced in an election a month ago, Robert Mugabe was more rigid. Unlike Nelson Mandela, he told the black people, go take the land. So they did. And the white land owners, some were killed, some were exiled, some were sidelined. What Mugabe didn't realize was that the world is run by white people. This world today is run by white people. Whether they are Russian whites or Western whites, is run by white people. So when you are a black person in a world like that and you want to bring about change, you have to take into consideration the powers that be. What will they allow? Because even white people have decency. All white people are not the same. And some white people want to see other people free. But when you are rigid and you treat all white people the same, then you burn your bridge. And you don't get the maximum support you need to work your way to full freedom in such a world. So Mugabe made that mistake and was sort of hardline without the power in the world to enforce his hardline. So over his 36-year rule, Zimbabwe just got poorer and poorer and more isolated, and the people suffered and suffered until his own inner core rebelled against him. When it appeared that he was about to install his wife as the next president, the military rebelled and pushed him aside. So your question, how is Zimbabwe doing now? They have a new opportunity to do better if the new leaders will understand the kind of world that Zimbabwe is in and make the right...
Yes,
the churches have been involved, and there are many denominations there, including United Methodists and Catholics and Lutherans, name it. They are all there, but the churches were not being listened to. In fact, to some extent, some of the churches compromised keeping their eyes fixed on Jesus in order to get a better life in this life. Some of the churches did that, and those churches became unpopular with the people whose aspirations were being sidelined by the greed of the church. The churches that remain faithful to the gospel have been thriving in Zimbabwe, because everyone was made to have full life, and anything less would be uncivilized. I'm taking that from a TV ad. There's some TV ad I used to run, something that I say, anything else will be uncivilized, you know. And so Zimbabwe has an opportunity now to write a new chapter in its long struggle for freedom. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Consider Christians to be sometimes bigots or look down on other people, or so they make their message softer, they liberalize it, the mainline churches, and they tend to be preaching these days, everybody gets into heaven.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may be why they're not talking about hell very much, and I wonder whether you think that the black church in America is better about hell in keeping, consonance with the gospel message. I mean, why is it that I think that they have a clearer vision of heaven and hell than the mainline liberal church? I don't know where I'm going with this, but do you?
Well, I'm not sure I would agree that the black churches have a better grip on that. I think the black church has a grip on some things, but because of its unique position of representing people who perceive themselves as oppressed and who are oppressed in some respects, so there is some Christianity there for wanting to do away with worldly oppression. But sometimes the black church is self-serving too. So just like the mainland churches have been going down, many black churches have been going down too, because there is this kind of preoccupation with earthly success instead of a longer-term view of destiny. And that is cutting across black, white, Korean, just name it. And so among white churches, there are faithful people. And faithfulness for me is not either conservative or liberal, because I think faithfulness, there are some things about faithfulness that has to be liberal, like injustice. To deal with injustice, the Christian has to be liberal to do away with things as they are. But to deal with truth, the church needs to be conservative, to conserve what is true. You know, so there are times like... in the book of Ecclesiastes, there's a time and a place for every matter under heaven. Wisdom is to know which is when. You know, I see that we are sort of way past our time. I didn't even realize it until I saw Elizabeth, who is my timekeeper. And sometimes when I don't want to stop, then I don't look Elizabeth's way. You know.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now you just did it for us. Mm-hmm. Nobody's getting up and going. That's what I noticed. But I think we need to officially end.
Yes.
And then if you're willing to chat with me,
yes. I'm here till tomorrow, so I'll stay here. Is there another group coming in here right away?
No.
So I'll just hang around when we close.
You can call in lunch.
Yes. Yes. Oh, yeah, yes.
Well,
yes. She said 2:15, there's another group. That's an early warning, you know. Yes.
Thank you.
It's been good being with you. Melody, could you close us with a prayer?
I will. Mm-hmm.